tear welling joy at one of their musical school recitals. In a narcoleptic patient with cataplexy, any one of these may cause the sufferer to collapse into the immobilized prison of his or her own body. Consider then how difficult it is to have a loving, pleasurable sexual relationship with a narcoleptic partner. The list becomes endless, with predictable and heart-wrenching outcomes. Unless patients are willing to accept these crumpling attacks, which is really no option of any kind, all hope of living an emotionally fulfilling life must be abandoned. A narcoleptic patient is banished to a monotonic existence of emotional neutrality. They must forfeit any semblance of succulent emotions that we are all nourished by on a moment-to-moment basis. It is the dietary equivalent of eating the same tepid bowl of unflavorful porridge day after day. You can well imagine the loss of appetite for such a life. If you saw a patient collapse under the influence of cataplexy, you would be convinced that they had fallen completely unconscious or into a powerful sleep. This is untrue. Patients are awake and continue to perceive the outside world around them. Instead, what the strong emotion has triggered is the total, or sometimes partial, body paralysis of REM sleep without the sleep of the REM state itself. Cataplexy is therefore an abnormal functioning of the REM sleep circuitry within the brain, wherein one of its features, muscle atonia, is inappropriately deployed while the individual is awake and behaving, rather than asleep and dreaming. We can, of course, explain this to an adult patient, lowering their anxiety during the event through comprehension of what is happening, and help them rein in or avoid emotional highs and lows to reduce cataplectic occurrences. However, this is much more difficult in a 10-year-old youngster. How can you explain such a villainous symptom and disorder to a child with narcolepsy? And how do you prevent a child from enjoying the normal roller coaster of emotional existence that is a natural and integral part of a growing life and developing brain? Which is to say, how do you prevent a child from being a child? There are no easy answers to these questions. We are, however, beginning to discover the neurological basis of narcolepsy and, in conjunction, more about healthy sleep itself. In Chapter 3, I describe the parts of the brain involved in the maintenance of normal wakefulness, the alerting, activating regions of the brainstem, and the sensory gate of the thalamus that sits on top, a setup that looks almost like a scoop of ice cream, thalamus, on a cone, brainstem. As the brainstem powers down at night, it removes its stimulating influence to the sensory gate of the thalamus. With the closing of the sensory gate, we stop perceiving the outside world, and thus we fall asleep. What I did not tell you, however, was how the brainstem knows that it's time to turn off the lights, so to speak, and power down wakefulness to begin sleep. Something has to switch the activating influence of the brainstem off, and in doing so, allow sleep to be switched on. That switch, the sleep-wake switch, is located just below the thalamus in the center of the brain, in a region called the hypothalamus. It is the same neighborhood that houses the 24-hour master biological clock, perhaps unsurprisingly. The sleep-wake switch within the hypothalamus has a direct line of communication to the power station regions of the brainstem. Like an electrical light switch, it can flip the power on, wake, or off, sleep. To do this, the sleep-wake switch in the hypothalamus releases a neurotransmitter called orexin. You can think of orexin as the chemical finger that flips the switch to the on, wakefulness position. When orexin is released down into your brainstem, the switch has been unambiguously flipped, powering up the wakefulness-generating centers of the brainstem. Once activated by the switch, the brainstem pushes open the sensory gate of the thalamus, allowing the perceptual world to flood into your brain, transitioning you to full, stable wakefulness. At night, the opposite happens. The sleep-wake switch stops releasing orexin onto the brainstem. The chemical finger has now flipped the switch to the off position, shutting down the rousing influence from the power station of the brainstem. The sensory business being conducted within the thalamus is closed down, by a sealing of the sensory gate. We lose perceptual contact with the outside world, and now sleep. Lights off, lights on, lights off, lights on. This is the neurobiological job of the sleep-wake switch in the hypothalamus, controlled by orexin. Ask an engineer what the essential properties of a basic electrical switch are, and they will inform you of an imperative. The switch must be definitive. It must either be fully on or fully off, a binary state. It must not float in a wishy-washy manner between the on and off positions. Otherwise, the electrical system will not be stable or predictable. Unfortunately, this is exactly what happens to the sleep-wake switch in the disorder of narcolepsy, caused by marked abnormalities of orexin. Scientists have examined the brains of narcoleptic patients in painstaking detail after they have passed away. During these post-mortem investigations, they discovered a loss of almost 90% of all the cells that produce orexin. Worse still, the welcome sites or receptors of orexin that cover the surface of the power station of the brainstem were significantly reduced in number in narcoleptic patients relative to normal individuals. Because of this lack of orexin, made worse by the reduced number of receptor sites to receive what little orexin does drip down, the sleep-wake state of the narcoleptic brain is unstable, like a faulty flip-flop switch. Never definitively on or off, the brain of a narcoleptic patient wobbles precariously around a middle point, teeter-tottering between sleep and wakefulness. The orexin-deficient state of this sleep-wake system is the main cause of the first and primary symptom of narcolepsy, which is excessive daytime sleepiness and the surprise attacks of sleep that can happen at any moment. Without the strong finger of orexin pushing the sleep-wake switch all the way over into a definitive on position, narcoleptic patients cannot sustain resolute wakefulness throughout the day. For the same reasons, narcoleptic patients have terrible sleep at night, dipping into and out of slumber in choppy fashion. Like a faulty light switch that endlessly flickers on and off, day and night, so goes the erratic sleep and wake experience suffered by a narcoleptic patient across each and every 24-hour period. Despite wonderful work by many of my colleagues, narcolepsy currently represents a failure of sleep research at the level of effective treatments. While we have effective interventions for other sleep disorders, such as insomnia and sleep apnea, we lag far behind the curve for treating narcolepsy. This is in part due to the rarity of the condition, making it unprofitable for drug companies to invest their research effort, which is often a driver of fast treatment progress in medicine. For the first symptom of narcolepsy, daytime sleep attacks, the only treatment used to be high doses of the wake-promoting drug amphetamine. But amphetamine is powerfully addictive. It is also a dirty drug, meaning that it is promiscuous and affects many different chemical systems in the brain and body, leading to terrible side effects. A newer, cleaner drug, called Provigil, is now used to help narcoleptic patients stay more stably awake during the day and has fewer downsides. Yet it is marginally effective. Antidepressants are often prescribed to help with the second and third symptoms of narcolepsy, sleep paralysis and cataplexy, as they suppress REM sleep, and it is REM sleep paralysis that is integral to these two symptoms. Nevertheless, antidepressants simply lower the incidence of both. They do not eradicate them. Overall, the treatment outlook for narcoleptic patients is bleak at present, and there is no cure in sight. Much of the treatment fate of narcolepsy sufferers and their families resides in the slower progressing hands of academic research, rather than the more rapid progression of big pharmaceutical companies. For now, patients simply must try to manage life with the disorder, living as best they can. Some of you may have had the same realization that several drug companies did when we learned about the role of orexin and the sleep-wake switch in narcolepsy. Could we reverse engineer the knowledge and, rather than enhance orexin to give narcoleptic patients more stable wakefulness during the day, try and shut it off at night, thereby offering a novel way of inducing sleep in insomnia patients. Pharmaceutical companies are indeed trying to develop compounds that can block orexin at night, forcing it to flip the switch to the off position, potentially inducing more naturalistic sleep than the problematic and sedating sleep drugs we currently have. Unfortunately, the first of these drugs, suvorexant, brand name Belsomra, has not proved to be the magic bullet many hoped. Patients in the FDA-mandated clinical trials fell asleep just 6 minutes faster than those taking a placebo. While future formulations may prove more efficacious, non-pharmacological methods for the treatment of insomnia, outlined in the next chapter, remain a far superior option for insomnia sufferers. Fatal familial insomnia. Michael Cork became the man who could not sleep, and paid for it with his life. Before the insomnia took hold, Cork was a high-functioning, active individual, a devoted husband, and a teacher of music at a high school in New Lexon, just south of Chicago. At age 40, he began having trouble sleeping. At first, Cork felt that his wife's snoring was to blame. In response to this suggestion, Penny Cork decided to sleep on the couch for the next 10 nights. Cork's insomnia did not abate, and only became worse. After months of poor sleep, and realizing the cause lay elsewhere, Cork decided to seek medical help. None of the doctors who first examined Cork could identify the trigger of his insomnia, and some diagnosed him with sleep-unrelated disorders, such as multiple sclerosis. Cork's insomnia eventually progressed to the point where he was completely unable to sleep. Not a wink. No mild sleep medications or even heavy sedatives could wrestle his brain from the grip of permanent wakefulness. Should you have observed Cork at this time, it would be clear how desperate he was for sleep. His eyes would make your own feel tired. His blinks were achingly slow, as if the eyelids wanted to stay shut mid-blink and not reopen for days. They telegraphed the most despairing hunger for sleep you could imagine. After 8 straight weeks of no sleep, Cork's mental faculties were quickly fading. This cognitive decline was matched in speed by the rapid deterioration of his body. So compromised were his motor skills that even coordinated walking became difficult. One evening, Cork was to conduct a school orchestral performance. It took several painful, though heroic, minutes for him to complete the short walk through the orchestra and climb atop the conductor's rostrum, all cane-assisted. As Cork approached the 6-month mark of no sleep, he was bedridden and approaching death. Despite his young age, Cork's neurological condition resembled that of an elderly individual in the end stages of dementia. He could not bathe or clothe himself. Hallucinations and delusions were rife. His ability to generate language was all but gone, and he was resigned to communicating through rudimentary head movements and rare inarticulate utterances whenever he could muster the energy. Several more months of no sleep, and Cork's body and mental faculties shut down completely. Soon after turning 42 years old, Michael Cork died of a rare, genetically inherited disorder called fatal familial insomnia, FFI. There are no treatments for this disorder, and there are no cures. Every patient diagnosed with the disorder has died within 10 months, some sooner. It is one of the most mysterious conditions in the annals of medicine, and it has taught us a shocking lesson. A lack of sleep will kill a human being. The underlying cause of FFI is increasingly well understood, and builds on much of what we have discussed regarding the normal mechanisms of sleep generation. The culprit is an anomaly of a gene called PRNP, which stands for prion protein. All of us have prion proteins in our brain, and they perform useful functions. However, a rogue version of the protein is triggered by this genetic defect, resulting in a mutated version that spreads like a virus. In this genetically crooked form, the protein begins targeting and destroying certain parts of the brain, resulting in a rapidly accelerating form of brain degeneration as the protein spreads. One region that this malfeasant protein attacks, and attacks comprehensively, is the thalamus, that sensory gate within the brain that must close shut for wakefulness to end and sleep to begin. When scientists performed post-mortem examinations of the brains of early sufferers of FFI, they discovered a thalamus that was peppered with holes, almost like a block of Swiss cheese. The prion proteins had burrowed throughout the thalamus, utterly degrading its structural integrity. This was especially true of the outer layers of the thalamus, which form the sensory doors that should close shut each night. Due to this puncturing attack by the prion proteins, the sensory gate of the thalamus was effectively stuck in a permanent, open position. Patients could never switch off their conscious perception of the outside world, and, as a result, could never drift off into the merciful sleep that they so desperately needed. No amount of sleeping pills or other drugs could push the sensory gate closed. In addition, the signals sent from the brain down into the body that prepare us for sleep, the reduction of heart rate, blood pressure, and metabolism, and the lowering of core body temperature, all must pass through the thalamus on their way down the spinal cord, and are then mailed out to the different tissues and organs of the body. But those signals were thwarted by the damage to the thalamus, adding to the impossibility of sleep in the patients. Current treatment prospects are few. There has been some interest in an antibiotic called doxycycline, which seems to slow the rate of the rogue protein accumulation in other prion disorders, such as Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease or so-called mad cow disease. Clinical trials for this potential therapy are now getting underway. Beyond the race for a treatment and cure, an ethical issue emerges in the context of the disease. Since FFI is genetically inherited, we have been able to retrospectively trace some of its legacy through generations. That genetic lineage runs all the way back into Europe, and specifically Italy, where a number of afflicted families live. Careful detective work has rolled the genetic timeline back further, to a Venetian doctor in the late 18th century, who appeared to have a clear case of the disorder. Undoubtedly, the gene goes back even further than this individual. More important than tracing the disease past, however, is predicting its future. The genetic certainty raises a eugenically fraught question. If your family's genes mean that you could one day be struck down by the fatal inability to sleep, would you want to be told your fate? Furthermore, if you know that fate and have not yet had children, would that change your decision to do so, knowing you are a gene carrier and that you have the potential to prevent a next step transmission of the disease? There are no simple answers. Certainly none that science can, or perhaps should, offer. An additionally cruel tendril of an already heinous condition. Sleep deprivation versus food deprivation. FFI is still the strongest evidence we have that a lack of sleep will kill a human being. Scientifically, however, it remains arguably inconclusive, as there may be other disease-related processes that could contribute to death, and they are hard to distinguish from those of a lack of sleep. There have been individual case reports of humans dying as a result of prolonged total sleep deprivation, such as Jiang Shaoshan. He was alleged to have stayed awake for 11 days straight to watch all the games of the 2012 European Soccer Championships, all the while working at his day job each day. On day 12, Shaoshan was found dead in his apartment by his mother from an apparent lack of sleep. Then there was the tragic death of a Bank of America intern, Moritz Erhardt, who suffered a life-ending epileptic seizure after acute sleep deprivation from the work overload that is so endemic and expected in that profession, especially from the juniors in such organizations. Nevertheless, these are simply case studies, and they are hard to validate and scientifically verify after the fact. Research studies in animals have, however, provided definitive evidence of the deadly nature of total sleep deprivation, free of any comorbid disease. The most dramatic, disturbing, and ethically provoking of these studies was published in 1983 by a research team at the University of Chicago. Their experimental question was simple: is sleep necessary for life? By preventing rats from sleeping for weeks on end in a gruesome ordeal, they came up with an unequivocal answer. Rats will die after 15 days without sleep, on average. Two additional results quickly followed. First, death ensued as quickly from total sleep deprivation as it did from total food deprivation. Second, rats lost their lives almost as quickly from selective REM sleep deprivation as they did following total sleep deprivation. A total absence of NREM sleep still proved fatal. It just took longer to inflict the same mortal consequence, 45 days on average. There was, however, an issue. Unlike starvation, where the cause of death is easily identified, the researchers could not determine why the rats had died following sleep's absence, despite how quickly death had arrived. Some hints emerged from assessments made during the experiment, as well as the later postmortems. First, despite eating far more than their sleep-rested counterparts, the sleep-deprived rats rapidly began losing body mass during the study. Second, they could no longer regulate their core body temperature. The more sleep-deprived the rats were, the colder they became, regressing toward ambient room temperature. This was a perilous state to be in. All mammals, humans included, live on the edge of a thermal cliff. Physiological processes within the mammalian body can only operate within a remarkably narrow temperature range. Dropping below or above these life-defining thermal thresholds is a fast track to death. It was no coincidence that these metabolic and thermal consequences were jointly occurring. When core body temperature drops, mammals respond by increasing their metabolic rate. Burning energy releases heat to warm the brain and body to get them back above the critical thermal threshold so as to avert death. But it was a futile effort in the rats lacking sleep. Like an old wood-burning stove whose top vent has been left open, no matter how much fuel was being added to the fire, the heat simply flew out the top. The rats were effectively metabolizing themselves from the inside out in response to hypothermia. The third, and perhaps most telling, consequence of sleep loss was skin deep. The privation of sleep had left these rats literally threadbare. Sores had appeared across the rat's skin, together with wounds on their paws and tails. Not only was the metabolic system of the rats starting to implode, but so too was their immune system. They could not fend off even the most basic of infections at their epidermis, or below it, as we shall see. If these outward signs of degrading health were not shocking enough, the internal damage revealed by the final postmortem was equally ghastly. A landscape of utter physiological distress awaited the pathologist. Complications ranged from fluid in the lungs and internal hemorrhaging to ulcers puncturing the stomach lining. Some organs, such as the liver, spleen, and kidneys, had physically decreased in size and weight. Others, like the adrenal glands that respond to infection and stress, were markedly enlarged. Circulating levels of the anxiety-related hormone, corticosterone, released by the adrenal glands, had spiked in the sleepless rats. What, then, was the cause of death? Therein lay the issue. The scientists had no idea. Not all the rats suffered the same pathological signature of demise. The only commonality across the rats was death itself, or the high likelihood of it, at which point the researchers euthanized the animals. In the years that followed, further experiments, the last of their kind, as scientists felt, rightly in my personal view, uneasy about the ethics of such experiments based on the outcome, finally resolved the mystery. The fatal final straw turned out to be septicemia, a toxic and systemic, whole organism, bacterial infection that coursed through the rat's bloodstream and ravaged the entire body until death. Far from a vicious infection that came from the outside, however, it was simple bacteria from the rat's very own gut that inflicted the mortal blow, one that an otherwise healthy immune system would have easily quelled when fortified by sleep. The Russian scientist, Marie de Menachin, had in fact reported the same mortal consequence of continuous sleep deprivation In the medical literature a century earlier, she noted that young dogs died within several days if prevented from sleeping, which are difficult studies for me to read, I must confess. Several years after Domenichin's studies, Italian researchers described equally lethal effects of total sleep deprivation in dogs, adding the observation of neural degeneration in the brain and spinal cord at post-mortem. It took another 100 years after the experiments of Domenichin and the advancements in precise experimental laboratory assessments before the scientists at the University of Chicago finally uncovered why life ends so quickly in the absence of sleep. Perhaps you have seen that small plastic red box on the walls of extremely hazardous work environments that has the following words written on the front: "Break glass in case of emergency." If you impose a total absence of sleep on an organism, rat or human, it indeed becomes an emergency, and you will find the biological equivalent of this shattered glass strewn throughout the brain and the body to fatal effect. This we finally understand. No, wait. You only need 6.75 hours of sleep. Reflecting on these deathly consequences of long-term, chronic, and short-term, acute, sleep deprivation allows us to address a recent controversy in the field of sleep research, one that many a newspaper, not to mention some scientists, apprehended incorrectly. The study in question was conducted by researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles, on the sleep habits of specific pre-industrial tribes. Using wristwatch activity devices, the researchers tracked the sleep of three hunter-gatherer tribes that are largely untouched by the ways of industrial modernity: the Saimin people in South America and the San and Hadza tribes in Africa, which we have previously discussed. Assessing sleep and wake times day after day across many months, the findings were thus: tribes people averaged just 6 hours of sleep in the summer and about 7.2 hours of sleep in the winter. Well-respected media outlets touted the findings as proof that human beings do not, after all, need a full 8 hours of sleep, some suggesting we can survive just fine on 6 hours or less. For example, the headline of one prominent U.S. newspaper read, "Sleep study on modern-day hunter-gatherers dispels notion that we're wired to need 8 hours a day." Others started out with the already incorrect assumption that modern societies need only 7 hours of sleep, and then questioned whether we even need that much. Do we really need to sleep 7 hours a night? How can such prestigious and well-respected entities reach these conclusions, especially after the science that I have presented in this chapter? Let us carefully reevaluate the findings and see if we still arrive at the same conclusion. First, when you read the paper, you will learn that the tribe's people were actually giving themselves a 7 to 8.5-hour sleep opportunity each night. Moreover, the wristwatch device, which is neither a precise nor gold-standard measure of sleep, estimated a range of 6 to 7.5 hours of this time was spent asleep. The sleep opportunity that these tribespeople provide themselves is therefore almost identical to what the National Sleep Foundation and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommend for all adult humans: 7 to 9 hours of time in bed. The problem is that some people confuse time slept with sleep opportunity time. We know that many individuals in the modern world only give themselves 5 to 6.5 hours of sleep opportunity, which normally means they will only obtain around 4.5 to 6 hours of actual sleep. So no, the finding does not prove that the sleep of hunter-gatherer tribes is similar to ours in this post-industrial era. They, unlike us, give themselves more sleep opportunity than we do. Second, let us assume that the wristwatch measurements are perfectly accurate, and that these tribes obtain an annual average of just 6.75 hours of sleep. The next erroneous conclusion drawn from the findings was that humans must, therefore, naturally need a mere 6.75 hours of sleep and no more. Therein lies the rub. If you refer back to the two newspaper headlines I quoted, you'll notice they both use the word need. But what need are we talking about? The incorrect presupposition made was this. Whatever sleep the tribe's people were obtaining is all that a human needs. It is flawed reasoning on two counts. Need is not defined by that which is obtained, as the disorder of insomnia teaches us, but rather whether or not that amount of sleep is sufficient to accomplish all that sleep does. The most obvious need, then, would be for life, and healthy life. Now we discover that the average lifespan of these hunter-gatherers is just 58 years, even though they are far more physically active than we are, rarely obese, and are not plagued by the assault of processed foods that erode our health. Of course, they do not have access to modern medicine and sanitation, both of which are reasons that many of us in industrialized first-world nations have an expected lifespan that exceeds theirs by over a decade. But it is telling that, based on epidemiological data, any adult sleeping an average of 6.75 hours a night would be predicted to live only into their early 60s, very close to the median lifespan of these tribes people. More prescient, however, is what normally kills people in these tribes. So long as they survive high rates of infant mortality and make it through adolescence, a common cause of death in adulthood is infection. Weak immune systems are a known consequence of insufficient sleep, as we have discussed in great detail. I should also note that one of the most common immune system failures that kills individuals in hunter-gatherer clans are intestinal infections, something that shares an intriguing overlap with the deadly intestinal tract infections that kill the sleep-deprived rats in the aforementioned studies. Recognizing this shorter lifespan, which fits well with the acclaimed shorter sleep amounts the researchers measured, the next error in logic many made is exposed by asking why these tribes would sleep what appears to be too little, based on all that we know from thousands of research studies. We do not yet know of all the reasons, but a likely contributing factor lies in the title we apply to these tribes, hunter-gatherers. One of the few universal ways of forcing animals of all kinds to sleep less than normal amounts is to limit food, applying a degree of starvation. When food becomes scarce, sleep becomes scarce, as animals try to stay awake longer to forage. Part of the reason that these hunter-gatherer tribes are not obese is because they are constantly searching for food, which is never abundant for long stretches. They spend much of their waking lives in pursuit and preparation of nutrition. For example, the Hadza will face days when they obtain 1,400 calories or less, and routinely eat 300 to 600 fewer daily calories than those of us in modern Western cultures. A large proportion of their year is therefore spent in a state of lower-level starvation, one that can trigger well-characterized biological pathways that reduce sleep time, even though sleep need remains higher than that obtained if food were abundant. Concluding that humans, modern living or pre-industrial, need less than 7 hours of sleep therefore appears to be a wishful conceit and a tabloid myth. Is sleeping 9 hours a night too much? Epidemiological evidence suggests that the relationship between sleep and mortality risk is not linear, such that the more and more sleep you get, the lower and lower your death risk, and vice versa. Rather, there is an upward hook in death risk once the average sleep amount passes 9 hours, resulting in a tilted backward J shape. 2 points are worthy of mention in this regard. First, should you explore those studies in detail, you learn that the causes of death in individuals sleeping 9 hours or longer include infection, for example pneumonia, and immune-activating cancers. We know from evidence discussed earlier in the book that sickness, especially sickness that activates a powerful immune response, activates more sleep. Ergo, the sickest individuals should be sleeping longer to battle back against illness using the suite of health tools sleep has on offer. It is simply that some illnesses, such as cancer, can be too powerful even for the mighty force of sleep to overcome, no matter how much sleep is obtained. The illusion created is that too much sleep leads to an early death, rather than the more tenable conclusion that the sickness was just too much, despite all efforts to the contrary from the beneficial sleep extension. I say more tenable rather than equally tenable, because no biological mechanisms that show sleep to be in any way harmful have been discovered. Second, it is important not to overextend my point. I'm not suggesting that sleeping 18 or 22 hours each and every day, should that be physiologically possible, is more optimal than sleeping 9 hours a day. Sleep is unlikely to operate in such a linear manner. Keep in mind that food, oxygen, and water are no different, and they too have a reverse J-shaped relationship with mortality risk. Eating to excess shortens life. Extreme hydration can lead to fatal increases in blood pressure associated with stroke or heart attack. Too much oxygen in the blood, known as hyperoxia, is toxic to cells, especially those of the brain. Sleep, like food, water, and oxygen, may share this relationship with mortality risk when taken to extremes. After all, wakefulness in the correct amount is evolutionarily adaptive, as is sleep. Both sleep and wake provide synergistic and critical, though often different, survival advantages. There is an adaptive balance to be struck between wakefulness and sleep. In humans, that appears to be around 16 hours of total wakefulness and around 8 hours of total sleep for an average adult. Chapter 13. iPads, factory whistles, and nightcaps. What's stopping you from sleeping? Many of us are beyond tired. Why? What precisely about modernity has so perverted our otherwise instinctual sleep patterns, eroded our freedom to sleep, and thwarted our ability to do so soundly across the night? For those of us who do not have a sleep disorder, the reasons underlying this state of sleep deficiency can seem hard to pinpoint, or, if seemingly clear, are erroneous. Beyond longer commute times and sleep procrastination, caused by late evening television and digital entertainment, both of which are not unimportant in their top and tail snipping of our sleep time and that of our children, 5 key factors have powerfully changed how much and how well we sleep. 1. Constant electric light as well as LED light. 2. Regularized temperature. 3. Caffeine, discussed in Chapter 2. 4. Alcohol. And 5. A legacy of punching time cards. It is this set of societally engineered forces that are responsible for many an individual's mistaken belief that they are suffering from medical insomnia. The dark side of modern light. At 255 to 257 Pearl Street, in Lower Manhattan, not far from the Brooklyn Bridge, is the site of arguably the most unassuming yet seismic shift in our human history. Here, Thomas Edison built the first power-generating station to support an electrified society. For the first time, the human race had a truly scalable method of unbuckling itself from our planet's natural 24-hour cycle of light and dark. With a proverbial flick of a switch came a whimsical ability to control our environmental light, and, with it, our wake and sleep phases. We, and not the rotating mechanics of planet Earth, would now decide when it was night and when it was day. We are the only species that has managed to light the night to such dramatic effect. Humans are predominantly visual creatures. More than a third of our brain is devoted to processing visual information, far exceeding that given over to sounds or smells, or those supporting language and movement. For early Homo sapiens, most of our activities would have ceased after the sunset. They had to, as they were predicated on vision, supported by daylight. The advent of fire, and its limited halo of light, offered an extension to post-dusk activities. But the effect was modest. In the early evening glow of firelight, nominal social activities such as singing and storytelling have been documented in hunter-gatherer tribes like the Hadza and the San. Yet the practical limitations of firelight nullified any significant influence on the timing of our sleep-wake patterns. Gas and oil-burning lamps and their forerunners, candles, offered a more forceful influence upon sustained nighttime activities. Gaze at a Renoir painting of 19th-century Parisian life, and you will see the extended reach of artificial light. Spilling out of homes and onto the streets, gas lanterns began bathing entire city districts with illumination. In this moment, the influence of man-made light began its re-engineering of human sleep patterns, and it would only escalate. The nocturnal rhythms of whole societies, not just individuals or single families, became quickly subject to light at night, and so began our advancing march toward later bedtimes. For the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the master 24-hour clock of the brain, the worst was yet to come. Edison's Manhattan power station enabled the mass adoption of incandescent light. Edison did not create the first incandescent light bulb. That honor went to the English chemist Humphrey Davy in 1802. But in the mid-1870s, Edison Electric Light Company began developing a reliable, mass-marketable light bulb. Incandescent light bulbs, and decades later, fluorescent light bulbs, guaranteed that modern humans would no longer spend much of the night in darkness, as we had for millennia past. 100 years post-Edison, we now understand the biological mechanisms by which the electric light bulbs managed to veto our natural timing and quality of sleep. The visible light spectrum, that which our eyes can see, runs the gamut from shorter wavelengths, approximately 380 nanometers, that we perceive as cooler violets and blues, to the longer wavelengths, around 700 nanometers, that we sense as warmer yellows and reds. Sunlight contains a powerful blend of all of these colors, and those in between, as the iconic Pink Floyd album cover of Dark Side of the Moon illuminates, so to speak. Before Edison, and before gas and oil lamps, the setting sun would take with it this full stream of daylight from our eyes, sensed by the 24-hour clock within the brain, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, described in Chapter 2. The loss of daylight informs our suprachiasmatic nucleus that nighttime is now in session. Time to release the brake pedal on our pineal gland, allowing it to unleash vast quantities of melatonin that signal to our brains and bodies that darkness has arrived and it is time for bed. Appropriately scheduled tiredness, followed by sleep, would normally occur several hours after dusk across our human collective. Electric light put an end to this natural order of things. It redefined the meaning of midnight for generations thereafter. Artificial evening light, even that of modest strength, or lux, will fool your suprachiasmatic nucleus into believing the sun has not yet set. The break on melatonin, which should otherwise have been released with the timing of dusk, remains forcefully applied within your brain under duress of electric light. The artificial light that bathes our modern indoor worlds will therefore halt the forward progress of biological time that is normally signaled by the evening surge in melatonin. Sleep in modern humans is delayed from taking off the evening runway, which would naturally occur somewhere between 8 and 10 p.m., just as we observe in hunter-gatherer tribes. Artificial light in modern societies thus tricks us into believing night is still day, and does so using a physiological lie. The degree to which evening electric light winds back your internal 24-hour clock is important, usually 2 to 3 hours each evening, on average. To contextualize that, let's say you are listening to this book at 11 p.m. in New York City, having been surrounded by electric light all evening. Your bedside clock may be registering 11 p.m., but the omnipresence of artificial light has paused the internal tick-tocking of time by hindering the release of melatonin. Biologically speaking, you've been dragged westward across the continent to the internal equivalent of Chicago time, 10 p.m., or even San Francisco time, 8 p.m. Artificial evening and nighttime light can therefore masquerade as sleep-onset insomnia, the inability to begin sleeping soon after getting into bed. By delaying the release of melatonin, artificial evening light makes it considerably less likely that you'll be able to fall asleep at a reasonable time. When you do finally turn out the bedside light, hoping that sleep will come quickly is made all the more difficult. It will be some time before the rising tide of melatonin is able to submerge your brain and body in peak concentrations, instructed by the darkness that only now has begun. In other words, before you are biologically capable of organizing the onset of robust, stable sleep. What of a petite bedside lamp? How much can that really influence your suprachiasmatic nucleus? A lot, it turns out. Even a hint of dim light, 8 to 10 lux, has been shown to delay the release of nighttime melatonin in humans. The feeblest of bedside lamps pumps out twice as much, anywhere from 20 to 80 lux. A subtly lit living room, where most people reside in the hours before bed, will hum at around 200 lux. Despite being just 1 to 2% of the strength of daylight, this ambient level of incandescent home lighting can have 50% of the melatonin-suppressing influence within the brain. Just when things looked as bad as they could get for the suprachiasmatic nucleus with incandescent lamps, a new invention in 1997 made the situation far worse. Blue light-emitting diodes, or blue LEDs. For this invention, Shuji Nakamura, Isamu Akasaki, and Hiroshi Amano won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2014. It was a remarkable achievement. Blue LED lights offer considerable advantages over incandescent lamps in terms of lower energy demands and, for the lights themselves, longer lifespans. But they may be inadvertently shortening our own. The light receptors in the eye that communicate daytime to the suprachiasmatic nucleus are most sensitive to short wavelength light within the blue spectrum, the exact sweet spot where blue LEDs are most powerful. As a consequence, evening blue LED light has twice the harmful impact on nighttime melatonin suppression than the warm yellow light from old incandescent bulbs, even when their lux intensities are matched. Of course, few of us stare headlong into the glare of an LED lamp each evening, but we do stare at LED-powered laptop screens, smartphones, and tablets each night, sometimes for many hours, often with these devices just feet or even inches away from our retinas. A recent survey of over 1,500 American adults found that 90% of individuals regularly used some form of portable electronic device 60 minutes or less before bedtime. It has a very real impact on your melatonin release, and thus ability to time the onset of sleep. One of the earliest studies found that using an iPad, an electronic tablet enriched with blue LED light, for 2 hours prior to bed, blocked the otherwise rising levels of melatonin by a significant 23%. A more recent report took the story several concerning steps further. Healthy adults lived for a 2-week period in a tightly controlled laboratory environment. The 2-week period was split in half, containing two different experimental arms that everyone passed through. 1. 5 nights of reading a book on an iPad for several hours before bed. No other iPad uses, such as email or internet, were allowed. And 2. 5 nights of reading a printed paper book for several hours before bed, with the two conditions randomized in terms of which the participants experienced as first or second. Compared to reading a printed book, reading on an iPad suppressed melatonin release by over 50% at night. Indeed, iPad reading delayed the rise of melatonin by up to 3 hours, relative to the natural rise in these same individuals when reading a printed book. When reading on the iPad, the melatonin peak, and thus instruction to sleep, did not occur until the early morning hours, rather than before midnight. Unsurprisingly, individuals took longer to fall asleep after iPad reading, relative to print copy reading. But did reading on the iPad actually change sleep quantity, quality, above and beyond the timing of melatonin? It did in 3 concerning ways. First, Individuals lost significant amounts of REM sleep following iPad reading. Second, the research subjects felt less rested and sleepier throughout the day following iPad use at night. Third was a lingering after effect, with participants suffering a 90-minute lag in their evening rising melatonin levels for several days after iPad use ceased, almost like a digital hangover effect. Using LED devices at night impacts our natural sleep rhythms, the quality of our sleep, and how alert we feel during the day. The societal and public health ramifications discussed in the penultimate chapter are not small. I, like many of you, have seen young children using electronic tablets at every opportunity throughout the day and evening. The devices are a wonderful piece of technology. They enrich the lives and education of our youth, but such technology is also enriching their eyes and brains with powerful blue light that has a damaging effect on sleep, the sleep that young, developing brains so desperately need in order to flourish. Footnote. For those wondering why cool blue light is the most potent of the visible light spectrum for regulating melatonin release, the answer lies in our distant ancestral past. Human beings, as we believe is true of all forms of terrestrial organisms, emerged from marine life. The ocean acts like a light filter, stripping away most of the longer, yellow and red wavelength light. What remains is the shorter, blue wavelength light. It is the reason the ocean, and our vision when submerged under its surface, appears blue. Much of marine life, therefore, evolved within the blue visible light spectrum, including the evolution of aquatic eyesight. Our biased sensitivity to cool blue light is a vestigial carryover from our marine forebears. Unfortunately, this evolutionary twist of fate has now come back to haunt us in a new era of blue LED light, discombobulating our melatonin rhythm and thus our sleep-wake rhythm. Due to its omnipresence, solutions for limiting exposure to artificial evening light are challenging. A good start is to create lowered, dim light in the rooms where you spend your evening hours. Avoid powerful overhead lights. Mood lighting is the order of the night. Some committed individuals will even wear yellow-tinted glasses indoors in the afternoon and evening to help filter out the most harmful blue light that suppresses melatonin. Maintaining complete darkness throughout the night is equally critical, the easiest fix for which comes from blackout curtains. Finally, you can install software on your computers, phones, and tablet devices that gradually desaturate the harmful blue LED light as evening progresses. Turning down the nightcap, alcohol. Short of prescription sleeping pills, the most misunderstood of all sleep aids is alcohol. Many individuals believe alcohol helps them to fall asleep more easily, or even offers sounder sleep throughout the night. Both are resolutely untrue. Alcohol is in a class of drugs called sedatives. It binds to receptors within the brain that prevent neurons from firing their electrical impulses. Saying that alcohol is a sedative often confuses people, as alcohol in moderate doses helps individuals liven up and become more social. How can a sedative enliven you? The answer comes down to the fact that your increased sociability is caused by sedation of one part of your brain, the prefrontal cortex, early in the timeline of alcohol's creeping effects. As we have discussed, this frontal lobe region of the human brain helps control our impulses and restrains our behavior. Alcohol immobilizes that part of our brain first. As a result, we loosen up, becoming less controlled and more extroverted. But anatomically targeted brain sedation, it still is. Give alcohol a little more time, and it begins to sedate other parts of the brain, dragging them down into a stupefied state, just like the prefrontal cortex. You begin to feel sluggish as the inebriated torpor sets in. This is your brain slipping into sedation. Your desire and ability to remain conscious are decreasing, and you can let go of consciousness more easily. I'm very deliberately avoiding the term sleep, however, because sedation is not sleep. Alcohol sedates you out of wakefulness, but it does not induce natural sleep. The electrical brainwave state you enter via alcohol is not that of natural sleep. Rather, it is akin to a light form of anesthesia. Yet this is not the worst of it when considering the effects of the evening nightcap on your slumber. More than its artificial sedating influence, alcohol dismantles an individual's sleep in an additional two ways. First, alcohol fragments sleep, littering the night with brief awakenings. Alcohol-infused sleep is therefore not continuous and, as a result, not restorative. Unfortunately, most of these nighttime awakenings go unnoticed by the sleeper, since they don't remember them. Individuals therefore fail to link alcohol consumption the night before with feelings of next-day exhaustion caused by the undetected sleep disruption sandwiched in between. Keep an eye out for that coincidental relationship in yourself and/or others. Second, alcohol is one of the most powerful suppressors of REM sleep that we know of. When the body metabolizes alcohol, it produces byproduct chemicals called aldehydes and ketones. The aldehydes in particular will block the brain's ability to generate REM sleep. It's rather like the cerebral version of cardiac arrest, preventing the pulsating beat of brainwaves that otherwise power dream sleep. People consuming even moderate amounts of alcohol in the afternoon and/or evening are thus depriving themselves of dream sleep. There is a sad and extreme demonstration of this fact observed in alcoholics who, when drinking, can show little in the way of any identifiable REM sleep. Going for such long stretches of time without dream sleep produces a tremendous build-up in and backlog of pressure to obtain REM sleep. So great, in fact, that it inflicts a frightening consequence upon these individuals: aggressive intrusions of dreaming while they are wide awake. The pent-up REM sleep pressure erupts forcefully into waking consciousness, causing hallucinations, delusions, and gross disorientation. The technical term for this terrifying psychotic state is delirium tremens. Should the addict enter a rehabilitation program and abstain from alcohol, the brain will begin feasting on REM sleep, binging in a desperate effort to recover that which it has long been starved of, an effect called the REM sleep rebound. We observe precisely the same consequences caused by excess REM sleep pressure in individuals who have tried to break the sleep deprivation world record before this life-threatening feat was banned. You don't have to be using alcohol to levels of abuse, however, to suffer its deleterious REM sleep disrupting consequences, as one study can attest. Recall that one function of REM sleep is to aid in memory integration and association, the type of information processing required for developing grammatical rules in new language learning, or in synthesizing large sets of related facts into an interconnected whole. To wit, researchers recruited a large group of college students for a 7-day study. The participants were assigned to one of three experimental conditions. On day one, all the participants learned a novel, artificial grammar, rather like learning a new computer coding language or a new form of algebra. It was just the type of memory task that REM sleep is known to promote. Everyone learned the new material to a high degree of proficiency on that first day, around 90% accuracy. Then, a week later, the participants were tested to see how much of that information had been solidified by the 6 nights of intervening sleep. What distinguished the three groups was the type of sleep they had. In the first group, the control condition, participants were allowed to sleep naturally and fully for all intervening nights. In the second group, the experimenters got the students a little drunk just before bed on the first night after daytime learning. They loaded up the participants with 2 to 3 shots of vodka mixed with orange juice, standardizing the specific blood alcohol amount on the basis of gender and body weight. In the third group, they allowed the participants to sleep naturally on the first and even the second night after learning, and then got them similarly drunk before bed on night 3. Note that all three groups learned the material on day 1 while sober, and were tested while sober on day 7. This way, Any difference in memory among the three groups could not be explained by the direct effects of alcohol on memory formation or later recall, but must be due to the disruption of the memory facility.